Welcome to Chain Reaction, the Foreign Policy Research Institute's flagship network of podcast series examining the political, security, economic, and social trends shaping Europe and Eurasia. Throughout the year, we're talking with experts about developments in Russia's war in Ukraine, the new European security order, the past, present, and future of the Baltic states, Russia's political economy, and great power competition in the region. Join us each month for
Bear Market Brief,
Baltic Ways,
Report in Short,
and of course, our flagship Chain Reaction. New episodes are available each week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This week on the Bear Market Brief.
Here's a family anecdote for you. My cousin was a pretty precocious kid, and at the age of about 5 or 6, was listening to the radio with my uncle, a program about nuclear weapons. After the program ended, he turned to my uncle and said, "Wait, so we have nuclear bombs, but we can't use them because Russia has them and would use them too." "Yes," my uncle said. He followed up, "And Russia has nuclear bombs, but they can't use them because we have nuclear bombs and would use them too." "Yes, that too," my uncle said. My cousin turned to my uncle and said, "Dad, that makes no sense." Smart kid, right? I'm Aaron Schwartzbaum, and this is the Bear Market Brief, a podcast about politics, economics, and the spaces in between in Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. On this episode, as you may have inferred, we will be talking about nuclear weapons. I think this is a particularly pertinent topic, given ambiguities surrounding Russia's strategic red lines and the introduction of new classes of weapons like hypersonic missiles. Vladimir Putin has certainly been making some statements about Russia's nuclear arsenal, and former President Medvedev has been adding some, shall we say, unhinged rejoinders. So let's break it down. Joining us this episode is Andrei Baklitsky, a senior researcher at the WMD program of the United Nations Institute of Disarmament Research. His current research focuses on nuclear risk reduction and nuclear arms control. Andrei holds a specialist diploma from Ural Federal University. He is also a member of the Deep Cuts Commission. He was previously a program director at PIR Center, a research fellow at the Diplomatic Academy of the Russian Foreign Ministry, a visiting research fellow at CSIS, and a senior research fellow at McGimo University. Andrei, welcome to the Bear Market Brief. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, question one, first and foremost, could you introduce yourself to the audience?
So my name is Andrei Baklitsky. I'm a senior researcher in the WMD program at UNIDIR, which is United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research. And I have to specify that I speak only for myself, not for UNIDIR or for UN.
The usual caveat. So let's jump straight into the contents for today. So we've seen around ongoing events in Ukraine, kind of off and on, but Putin and other Russian military leaders talk about nuclear weapons, sometimes saber rattling, sometimes the opposite. No, we can't win a nuclear war. We have no desire. But it goes back and forth. Can you share a little bit about Russia's nuclear doctrine? What does it say about when Russia might actually use nuclear weapons?
So Russia doesn't have a dedicated nuclear doctrine like the United States. So it has a couple of paragraphs in its broader military doctrine, which talks about those things. And then it has something called the foundations or the basic principles of the state policy on nuclear deterrence, specifically from 2020. And in both of those documents, it's pretty clear saying that the decision will be made by the president. So the president has the sole authority to use nuclear weapons as he or she, in our case, he sees fit. And then there are like a number of conditions under which Russia would consider. But of course, you know, we don't know how any of this could go. Russia can then decide that even though those conditions are met, you wouldn't use nuclear weapons because, again, fundamentally, it's the president who makes the decision. So the two conditions from the military doctrine are quite, you know, non-controversial. One is the use of WMD against Russia or its allies. Then Russia could retaliate with nuclear weapons. And the second one is conventional war when the very existence of the state is under threat. It wasn't ever clarified what exactly existence of state means, but you would think about something like NATO tanks rolling in Moscow, which again seems pretty unlikely. And then the document I mentioned from 2020 kind of adds some nuances. So the one is if there is a reliable information that ballistic missiles are launched towards Russia and they are flying already, Russia can respond with nuclear weapons before being hit. And then the second point is that if Russian infrastructure, which enables nuclear forces, is being attacked in a way that Russia wouldn't be able to use its forces. So Russia can also consider nuclear use, which again, those are slightly more specific. But then even during the Cold War, both sides understand that you don't want to mess with each other's nuclear forces or systems enabling nuclear forces. So that's pretty much part of the course. Well, the caveat, of course, to all of those things, which as I just said, Russian military doctrine is from 2014. So it's been a while, but those are the official documents we still have.
So editorializing for a second here, none of what you mentioned sounds particularly controversial. I think all those points, if we're being technical, sound reasonable enough. When Putin and other folks in his circle talk about nuclear weapons, then I think you could frame it that you can use nuclear weapons without using them. I'm making air quotes. What do they want when they bring that up? What is the aim?
Well, the majority of statements, especially from President Putin, we can say, we can talk about other officials, especially, you know, Dmitry Medvedev, who is very unorthodox on those things, who was former Russian president, now he's a deputy head of Russian Security Council. But when I talk about President Putin, he's mostly talking within those doctrinal things, not going too far out of this, you know, guardrails. And his points are oftentimes like, oh, if someone will try to, the West, meaningly, will try to fight a war with Russia that would escalate to the nuclear threshold, meaning that at some point, some of those red lines Russia has laid would be crossed, and, you know, that would lead to nuclear war, and that's, nobody wants that, so the West should not intervene, especially given the asymmetry of stakes. Russia is very, very invested in what it's doing. The West is not, so, like, why would you even want to go there? And, you know, I think this understanding from the beginning of the war was that the West should not directly interfere in the war. And it was shared by both sides. We hear it from President Biden. We hear it from many heads of European states, unlike President Macron as of lately, but the majority still share this idea. And then Russia also kind of share this view that, like, the West should not interfere because it could end with nuclear war. But other than that, West has been doing pretty much everything else. It could, providing, you know, all kind of information, material, support, training. So I think we can say that this part, you know, of involvement is kind of in gray zone because it doesn't really fill into those conditions. So then, you know, not much we can do with nuclear weapons about them.
One thing that I hear Putin talk about a lot when nuclear weapons come up is Russia's arsenal of highly advanced weaponry. And I think we get here to the topic of hypersonic weapons. And I have, I guess, kind of a fundamental question here. Like, hypersonic meaning multiple times the speed of sound. When you fire an old school nuclear missile, an intercontinental ballistic missile, it goes to space. And yeah, then it comes down really, really, really fast. Yeah. So isn't that already hypersonic? What's the difference between that kind of hypersonic and when we talk about hypersonics now? What do they actually do? Why are they different?
Right. So hypersonic is between 525 times the speed of sound, which again is, you can go in all sorts of complexity because speed of sound is different below the ground and high up in the atmosphere because the atmosphere is just so much thinner up there. But yeah, it's something about 1 to 5 miles per second, so 1.6 to 8 kilometers per second. Yeah, that's pretty fast. And you are totally right. The first, you know, starting from V2, I think, missiles, so like in the 40s, German missiles were already hypersonic when they were re-entering the atmosphere. But what are we specifically talking at the moment is this speed, but also maneuverability and precision. When we talk about hypersonic those days, this is not only ballistic missiles, ICBMs, but also like hypersonic cruise missiles, which are like small, well, not even small, but like plane-like things which can fly, which have powered flight all over its trajectory. So Russia has once a missile called Zircon, which it seems to have been using in Ukraine for, you know, the last maybe a month or something. Then those could be air-launched ballistic missiles, which you launch from planes. So something like Russia's Kinjal. And then, yeah, you have strategic boost glide vehicles, so-called boost glide vehicles like Avangard, which is launched into the Visa normal classical ICBM, but then it separates and starts gliding in the atmosphere, also really fast, but also it can change trajectory while it's gliding. So the ballistic missiles, they are fast, but they're predictable. Once you know how it was launched, you basically know where it's going to fall because you have this ballistic, you know, curve. All of those guys can change their trajectory mid-flight, so presumably they are much harder to intercept. So, of course, if you're talking hypersonic cruise missiles like Zircon, they are still flying in the atmosphere, and they're not, you know, hypersonic during all of its flight. So there's also caveats there. And, you know, if something's flying in the atmosphere, it produces, you know, they're quite visible in the atmosphere. So they're all other trade-offs. So all in all, I would say those are kind of new weapons, new types of weapons, but I wouldn't say they're like game changers or anything like that. And we've seen, you know, both Zircons and Kinjals being used in Ukraine with no major consequence, I would say.
So is the introduction, and this is not just for Russia specifically, because China's developing them, the US is developing them, is it escalatory in some way? Does it make the world more dangerous, or is it kind of similar to the weaponry that everybody, or most countries, not even most countries, but a few countries already have?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, Zircon and Kinjal and conventional, these conventional warheads, they are not necessarily part of this whole nuclear thing. They are dual capable. They can host nuclear weapons as well, but, you know, they can be used as conventional weapons. So in that sense, if we don't believe that there'll be ever a conventional war between Russia and the US, for example, because with all the possible consequences, then it doesn't really matter for this broader, you know, strategic stability. Some people can say, well, you can still target nuclear weapons with those, and they could be more capable, they can penetrate missile defense and so on and so forth. But really, that's, you know, that's conventional forces. And then we can have a separate discussion about how conventional impacts a nuclear. Avangard, yes, it can kind of penetrate missile defenses. So you can kind of see how those could be better suited for attacks against, you know, US mainland. But then again, it's not like existing missile defenses can stop current Russian attack against US or US attack against Russia, because there's just too many warheads and not enough interceptors. So you can say that while it might have marginal additional, you know, penetration power, but in reality, I'm not sure Russia doesn't even need it. So yeah.
That is a great segue, because I wanted to ask a little bit about missile defense. And yeah, it seems to me that there's kind of a fundamental math problem that even if you have a perfect interceptor that can knock a warhead out of the sky 100% of the time, which is tough. Again, these things are moving really, really fast. If you're under attack from 1,000 warheads and you have 500 interceptors, basic subtraction, that's easy math. That part is easy. So to the actual question, why has, and I think this is the United States particularly, invested so much? What is the point of missile defense? Is it even viable as a strategy?
I mean, the whole point of missile defense generally is very appealing, right? Who would be against protecting from missiles flying at you, like shooting missiles down? There's damage limitation, you receive less damage. So it makes like perfect sense when you think about it, but then I don't think this equation works with nuclear weapons, as you said. Because even if, you know, you destroy 90%, he was talking about 50%, even like 90% from what Russia has, 1,500. So if imagine 150 warheads gets to United States cities, that's you know, the civilization as we know is over. So damage limitation in nuclear war, I would say, doesn't work. You cannot get out of this predicament with missile defenses. But then I think this concept is so powerful, you don't want to be unprotected. Like when you know there is this huge nuclear arsenal which can come your way, you want something to protect yourself of, despite the fact that it probably won't, and probably it could be even counterproductive, but there's this feeling. And also in the US, it seems there is vested almost like religious investment in the missile defense. This became part of identity for so many people that they just don't want to let it go. And it's been, you know, a big problem in U.S.-Russian relations and Soviet-Russian relations for a while, because, again, as we know, current missile defenses wouldn't be able to stop Russia's attack. But then there's always this hope on one side and fear on the other side that maybe somehow you can, maybe there'll be some technical solution, maybe new technologies will help us, and at some point you can create this 100% impenetrable missile defense. So that pushes Russia to invest in some of the more offensive systems, like some of those hypersonic systems. And then it makes, in the US, people think, well, maybe if we throw some more money on it, maybe we can crack this.
Understood. One thing I wanted to double click on, just because you mentioned it earlier, you did talk about the interplay between conventional and nuclear. And I think that could be a whole episode in itself, if not a book or several episodes. But if we could quickly touch on that, where are the boundaries between conventional? I mean, obviously it's nuclear weapons versus not, but how would you describe that interplay to someone who is not working in the space? I guess that's the question.
Well, as you said, it's very complicated because we went a long way from considering nuclear weapons as just type of weapon. You know, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it was considered as like just bombs as all other bombs, just bigger, stronger, but basically you can carpet bomb with them as good as you did, you know, fire bombings of Tokyo or Dresden or what have you. But then as time went on, you were still like, well, we have higher and higher arsenals, higher and higher yields. And at some point, people understood that this is not going to work out. If you start using those, you're probably going to die and everybody's going to die. So we cannot really use them. But then still, all those times, we still have plans to use them. And some of those were integrated with conventional weapons because you presumably would be fighting conventional war, which would then escalate. And if you read all sorts of documents from the Cold War, it was like, okay, so how many hundreds of nuclear warheads we use when, you know, advancing tank armies going through the Balkans and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of those plans in the military, despite the fact that pretty much everybody was like, no, that's not going to work. And of course, you know, in the NATO countries, they had nuclear weapons prepared to stop those advancing Soviet tanks, which were going toward La Manche or what have you. For the last, I would say, 3 decades, there was not much talk about nuclear at all. Cold War ended, everybody had other things to care about, and it was slowly drifting in the, you know, attic of consciousness that, like, they exist, they're important, but really we are fighting those conventional wars, and this is where we're heading. Now, great power competition is back, and everybody talking about fighting great power wars. So now there's a lot of talk like, well, how all of those things impact each other. So where does nuclear fall within this? Where does it fall within escalation ladder? When you start using nuclear weapons, and some of this we touched a little bit when talking about Russian doctrine, but also what does it can be used for, and dusting off some of those Cold War scenarios, which I think is quite unsettling, because I really believe nuclear weapons are best kept in these attics until we kind of dispose of them. Using them would be crazy.
Another great segue here. a lot of good segues today. Talk about arms control, because yes, using them would, I think we can all agree, would be crazy. I think we need to go back in history a little bit, maybe late Cold War. Tell me about some of the foundational arms control agreements. I think we can focus on like the nuclear side of that. What existed, and we'll talk about the status today, but kind of traditionally, what did that regime look like?
Yeah, so from around 1970s and into the 1980s, we kind of created this system, which was Soviet and then Russian-US arms control model, which limited strategic nuclear forces, the forces which you can shoot each other at from Russia into US, from US into Russia. So they were limited. You had a limited number of those. Then you also have Missile Defense Treaty, ABM Treaty, which limited the number of interceptors at very low numbers. It was something like 100 interceptors, and there was many thousands of offensive weapons. So it made ABM kind of irrelevant for this strategic interplay. And then everything beneath the strategic level, from range of 5,500 kilometers to the range of 500 kilometers, was banned. There were no ground-launched missiles of this range because of the INF treaty. So you had limits at the top, nothing in between, and then below 500 kilometers, you can build whatever you want, but basically with that, you cannot really threaten each other, and missile defense was limited. And that been kind of the structure which started unraveling in 2002 when US left ABM treaty. So no more limitations on missile defense. Then INF treaty, US was saying Russia was in violation, and it left in 2019. And then the new START treaty, the strategic treaty, was suspended in 2003 by Russia because of the war and how, you know, US basically wasn't acting good towards Russia. So now, in effect, we don't have any of those big elements we used to have, which is kind of worrisome.
Now, I guess we turn to the present situation. And I know there's still been contacts at varying points about arms control. I guess the kind of bleak question is how bad is it? Is there any foreseeable chance of breakthroughs on disarmament with, you know, all that's happening with the war in Ukraine?
Well, I think, interestingly enough, we are not into the arm race for the moment, at least not between Russia and the United States. And the reason for it is manifold. One thing, US cannot really do neutral arms racing at the moment until, I would say, the end of the decade, at least maybe longer, just because US industry is not ready for it. US in the process of modernization, which means you need to build new missiles, new submarines, new warheads just to replenish your stocks. And just add on top of that, that's not really feasible for the moment. And, you know, Russia seems to have other things to do for the moment. It has its plate full with Ukraine. What we know about Russia doesn't indicate its arms racing. But in general, it's really hard to say what Moscow position is on nuclear issues for the moment. What we see now is not a position. It's posing the existing position and discontinuing engagement with Washington because of the war of Ukraine. So it's like jumping over the gap, and Russia is kind of still in the air, and it's impossible to say where it goes when it lands. It seems to have been planned as a short jump, but now we're in the third year of this jump, and yeah, we just cannot move anywhere because this is all suspended, and yeah, we just watch as the world goes about without, it seems, any, you know, coherent strategy or plan or what have you. And at the same time, we have developments with China, which US intelligence community believes has been increasing its arsenal at a very fast rate. So maybe this whole Russian-US dynamic will be just overtaken by the events. And when Russia lands and maybe decides that it wants arms control, maybe there'll be just no space in it in the world of rising China and maybe Republican US president.
On that very cheerful note, Andre, thank you for joining the Bear Market Brief.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Andre and to you, listener, for joining. And yeah, you may have heard different opinions from an American specialist. The whole idea here was to have someone by who came up in Russia's strategic culture. So what do you think? Reach out on Twitter/X at the handle @BearMarketBrief. The Bear Market Brief is a project of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, that's FPRI, a nonpartisan think tank based in Philadelphia. For more information on this initiative and on many others, visit fpri.org. We'll catch you next time.